Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I am well. You are moving well.
Thanks. I'm getting there.
That's good.
Yeah, range of motion is the phrase of the month.
I see. R-O-M.
Yeah.
ROM.
And riding the spin bike to nowhere to try and keep a little condition up on the sides.
You're not ready to get up on the rollers yet.
Oh, no. Riding rollers is probably more risky than riding on the road
at this point.
So I will stay on the stationary bike for now.
That's true. Well, you know, your bike is in better shape than you.
It probably is.
Yeah, we put it through its paces this week, and it's doing okay. It needs some headset parts, but other than that, it got its new wheel, and we'll see if you want to make some decisions about it.
Okay.
All right.
So what's new in cycling this week?
A lot of things are new. You know, I do a lot of research before the show each week, and it takes me down some interesting roads once in a while. And this was one of the more interesting weeks. I find almost all of our guests are pretty noteworthy.
Mm-hmm.
But once in a while, you run into someone who seems to be more than on just a few favorite lists.
Mm-hmm.
So you might remember back in, I think it was July or August, Velo News shook up the bike race journal world by laying off most of its senior editors,
mm-hmm.
including Steve Frothingham, Ben Delaney, John Wilcoxon, and our guest this evening, senior tech editor Charles Pelkey. Patrick O'Grady, you know, Mad Dog,
mm-hmm.
yeah, said of Charles, "Charles Pelkey is one of those Renaissance types who seems to gravitate towards cycling." So in return, it seems that the people gravitate to Charles. On the same day that his pink slip arrived from Velo News, Charles also received the grim news that he had cancer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So almost immediately, this is very cool. The cycling world responded with a huge outpouring of goodwill as well as a website to raise money to help defray what has become a mountain of medical bills because he got laid off.
Mm-hmm.
He had to go to the Cobra thing. And
right.
then, you know, so. Oof. So now Charles is still talking the talk, though. He writes his explainer column, which he used to do for Velo News. You'd ask him a question.
Mm-hmm.
He'd explain it to you.
Yeah.
And he's writing it for Red Kite Prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, as we said last week, one of the top 10 blogs for outside. He's still breaking down races at liveupdateguy.com, and he practices law. He's an attorney.
Okay.
We'll actually unwind his history, his thoughts, and how things are turning out for him in a few minutes. And there's a lot that he's done in the past. We also have two people, Chris Mooney and Stefan Walls. They are the co-authors of a really fascinating new book titled Tucson Spokes, a photo collection of the Tucson cycling community. We have a lot of cycling going on in Northeast Ohio, but let me tell you, Tucson has it really going on. As many of you know, I love beautiful books, and this one is unique and beautiful in many ways. The photography's by Chris. Stefan did the layout design and typography. It's an 84-page full-color book, and Tucson shows up as a great place to live and ride. The book introduces a wide variety of people, places, and ideas about cycling. So let me just read you real quick the foreword of the book. It's by the lifelong Tucson cyclist and world-class triathlete Jimmy Riccitiello. And he says, "Over time and many, many miles on two wheels, I've come to realize that Tucson's roads and trails have provided me with an education, perspective, friendships, and health that money can't buy. That's part of the beauty of Tucson. Tucson is cycling, and the community is so developed and sincere and welcoming that anyone who throws their leg over a bicycle for the first time is made to feel special here." I know I have a small collection of the Tour de Tucson posters,
mm-hmm.
which is one of their super-duper rides, and I've always thought it would be a cool place to visit. Well, after looking through all these photographs, my book never arrived, so they sent me a very special link, and
mm-hmm.
I got to page through it. It's a very, very cool book. And then I've got news from all over the world, as well as some interesting news from the streets blog of D.C., but it's about Ohio.
Hmm.
Mm. So sit back, Enjoy. We're going to welcome Charles Pelkey to the Outspoken Cyclist. Good evening, Charles. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, no problem at all.
I don't know much about Wyoming, but I think of it as big skies, lots of space, and animals that are allowed to run free.
Well, we do have more antelope or pronghorn antelope than people. So, yeah, we have 500,000 people, and I think there's like 600,000 antelope here. It's
so
a big state. It's about the size of Colorado with about a tenth of the population. So.
Wow. So you're in Laramie.
I am.
And how big is Laramie?
29,000, I think.
That's so cool.
It's really cool.
That is very cool. Have you always lived in Wyoming?
No, I'm originally from Germany. And I moved to the U.S. when I was an 8-year-old kid and moved to Colorado and then decided to come here when I was 18 to go to college. And I've been in and out of Laramie quite a bit over the last 30-some years, but I keep finding myself back. They call it the Laramie rubber band effect. Get so far out, and then they pull you right back in again.
Yeah, the boing-boing effect?
Exactly.
I got it. You know, many of the guests who come on our show started their bicycle calling, if you want to call it that, back in the 70s and 80s and 90s,
yeah,
which is when you started racing. How would you characterize your race years?
Oh, some of the most enjoyable I ever had in my life. I mean, it was, you know, I was certainly no professional. The best I ever got was category two on the road. But it was fun. I mean, I just absolutely loved it. And it was something that I, you know, always caught my interest suddenly found myself in a situation where I actually had an opportunity to work in the field, and I quit what most other people would say was a phenomenally good job to take it. So,
when you mean Velo News?
Yeah,
we'll get to that.
News,
yeah.
I quit working as a press secretary in the U.S. Senate for the then GOP whip, Alan Simpson, but Simpson was cool with it, and we stay friends.
So that was back in
1994.
Okay, so you were in D.C. then for a period of time?
Yeah, actually I was. My son was born out there and everything.
Interesting. Did you like being in Washington?
You know, I was kind of a casual, hippy-dippy sort of bike racing news reporter when I was out here in Wyoming. And, you know, I'm a Democrat. I wore shorts to work. Suddenly, my office overlooked the Laramie Valley and the Snowy Range Mountains, and the next thing I know, I'm in Washington, D.C., wearing suits and, you know,
on the Beltway,
spouting the Republican line, which was, at the time wasn't as extreme as it is now, but it was still, you know, not necessarily what, you know, the position that I personally held, but it was an interesting experience.
How did you go from being who you were in Laramie to a Republican Senate press secretary?
Yeah, it was pretty interesting.
That's
experience.
Interesting.
You know, it's a small state. You know, it's a small state. You get to know other people. And Simpson and his older brother Pete, you know, they apparently respected the work I was doing as a reporter, and my politics never came into it when I was a reporter. So I got a job offer, and I took it. But, you know, when the offer at Velo News, you know, I mean, it was, you know, it was an opportunity to work in a field that I really liked, and it was fun. And, you know, and we had a new son and wanted to move back west, so
yeah,
we did. So.
So you were a journalist, you were press secretary, you're also an attorney, which is what you're doing now, too.
Yeah, I'm sitting in my law office right now as we speak.
Man of many hats that you are.
Well, I you know, I was always embarrassed because I never had an undergraduate college degree, and my son talked me into applying for law school, even without it, and I got in, and, you know, he was 10 when he talked me into it, and I sort of had to live up to my son's expectations, and so I went to law school.
And how old is your son now?
He's 17.
So you've been an attorney for 7 years.
No, I've been an attorney for 2 years now. So.
Oh,
yeah,
okay. So it's a new
profession. I had to go through law school, and I had to go through the application process and all
sure.
that. So.
So put your Velo News time in time. When?
Okay.
What were the years that you were senior technical editor at Velo News?
Well, I started out as technical editor, and then I became news editor.
Okay.
And then I became the editor of VeloNews.com. And then because they wanted to have an editor in-house and I had already moved out of the building, they brought a new editor in and they made me, they gave me the title of senior editor.
Which, so is that Steve?
Senior, yeah, Steve Frothing.
Yeah, he was on the show earlier this year.
Yeah. No, they brought Steve in 2008, 2007, I can't remember. But then Steve, you know, Steve stayed there until just this year, and he left right after I did.
Yeah, well, yeah. We'll get to that. That's an interesting story, I'm sure. So as technical editor, first of all, I'd like to know where you got your technical background, and then you wrote a column, and you still write a column called The Explainer.
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me a little bit about your technical background and The Explainer.
Well, they're not related.
Okay.
My technical background mostly came from running a bike shop for a while with my wife, and, you know, I just did, you know, I was back in the day when mechanicking was a little bit simpler than it is now. And I, you know, I just learned as much as I could. And then, you know, I mean, when I was hired as technical editor of LA News, if I didn't know something, I would learn it as quickly as I could. And that's basically where I came from. I'm sure that there were a lot of people out in the industry who were probably dissatisfied with how much or how little I learned. But I had an interesting time with that. But my real love is, you know, was news. And they made me news editor. And that's really where I got into, you know, writing about doping and some of the more controversial stuff, and I kind of enjoyed that, too.
What do you think about that?
Of doping?
Well, of just the whole controversy and how it's starting to pan out.
Well, I mean, in 1998, when I was stopped by the tour for one day, and it turned into a three-and-a-half-week assignment following the Festina scandal around, I've been following doping ever since really closely. They're making great strides. You know, I think the biological passport, the more rigorous testing that's going on right now, I think we're making progress. Is the sport going to be entirely rid of it? Probably not, but we're certainly in a lot better shape than we were in 1998.
Would you say that's not just in the U.S., that's worldwide? It's changing?
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Worldwide, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, in fact, I would say that the progress on the global stage has been much greater than it has been here in the U.S.
Interesting.
Largely because the sport's bigger globally than it is here in the U.S. and there's a, you know, there's a lot more rigorous testing out there. I mean, here in the U.S. there are still surprising gaps in testing, political battles over who gets to do the testing and stuff. I have a lot of respect for the way they run the program at USADA.
Okay. I take some time to try to ask people who come on the show who have raced in the past, mm-hmm. and say, what do you see from when you were in the peloton to what is going on now? And these people are no longer, obviously, you know, world-class in the peloton racers. And, yeah, I've heard things. People like Eric Heiden would say, well, technology has changed so much. Now you've got this constant communication between the racer and his team manager, for example.
Yeah.
But, you know, from your perspective, what do you see has changed more than anything else?
Well, I mean, I think the sport has grown in importance in a lot of ways. You know, you look back at even 1976 Tour de France or something. I mean, the scale is just massive at this point. And it's, unfortunately, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, the money tends to drift towards the really big events. And I don't think there's as much balance in the sport anymore. But, the sport has turned into something, you know, the sport has grown in significance and it's grown quite a bit. It's a spectacular sport. I like a lot of the developments in the sport. The thing that makes me sad is that we still have, you know, we're still discussing doping. I mean, that bothers me.
It'd be nice to have it in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the one technological development that occurred in the late 1980s that actually almost came close to destroying the sport.
Yes.
That was the development of EPO. And back in the old days, people would take amphetamines and things like that, and that would give them a slight boost. But we're talking about a quantitative difference between that and EPO. I mean, EPO is a measurable performance enhancer where, you know, you get a 10 to 15% performance increase. You know, and particularly in a 3-week tour that's, often won by less than a minute, that's a major deal.
Sure.
So
I want to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Charles Pelkey. He's in Laramie, Wyoming, the Big Sky state, one of them, with not too many people. I think that's kind of cool.
It is.
I'd like to not dwell on it, but tell me what happened at Velo News. What happened last summer?
I'm sure it was a business decision. And, the one thing about living in Laramie, Wyoming, when you're working for a magazine like Velo News, is, first of all, the magazine itself is based in Boulder, but the ownership is based in San Diego. Those business decisions were made somewhere else and had, and I was certainly not involved in it, and that's not my area of specialty. I think a quick look at my bank account would show you that I'm not a business specialist. But, the decision was made. It's my understanding that the decision was made during the Tour de France this year to let both me and John Wilcoxon go. I don't think that they knew when they made that decision that I had cancer, but I believe they found out before they let me know. They have a business to run. They make their business decisions. And, John was one of the founding purchasers of Velo News when they bought it from the folks in Brattleboro, Vermont.
Right.
And then I was there for 17 years.
Well, but it was also Ben and it was Steve. I mean,
no,
they...
Ben left on his own accord.
Oh, he did. Okay.
And Steve left, when he joined rejoined Bicycle Retailer.
Yeah.
He used to work for him back in the day.
Okay. Because it made it sound like the four of you were sort of like dumped all at the same time.
No, it was just John and me on the 27th of July.
And
the reason I know that is because about an hour after I got the phone call, I also had a doctor's appointment. I got the confirmation of my cancer diagnosis.
Which we aren't also going to dwell on, but how is your treatment going?
I could be really positive about it, but I got to admit chemo sucks.
Yeah, it's basically putting poison in your system, so
yeah,
I definitely understand.
Not. Yeah, I have another round tomorrow, so, that's the reason I sound, marginally lucid at this point, is because, I get a dose tomorrow, and by Monday I'll be, mumbling.
So how often do you need to actually do these treatments?
Once a week.
And for how long?
It takes about 4.5 hours.
No, well, I meant, okay, that's true, but I meant...
Oh, no, oh, okay.
The other four
long. Yeah, it was 20 weeks, so...
Oh, my goodness, and how many weeks are you into it?
13, so I have 7 left.
Well, you're on the downside, that's
yeah,
a cool
exactly.
thing. Well, you sound really, really good.
Yeah, I try to maintain a positive attitude. It's been a weird year, I can guarantee that.
I guess.
But, one of the things you asked about was the explainer column.
And
one
I was just going to go back to that.
At Velo News was, we used to have Bob Bianski,
right.
Who was an attorney.
Right.
And he did Legally Speaking, and that was a column that I got started, and Bob approached us about doing that, but then he moved on to Bicycling Magazine, and I tried to fill the void. When I started that column, I wasn't a lawyer, I did a lot of things in the explainer, including history of cycling and a number of other things, rules, doping stuff, but more and more I got legal questions, and by the time I graduated from law school and passed the bar and all that, I felt a little bit more comfortable answering those questions than I did, when I was just a law student. So it's, it's kind of evolved. After I got laid off from Velo News, Steve, when he was still there, offered to put the explainer on Velo News twice a month to keep the readership that had developed around that column. And then when I learned that Steve was leaving, Patrick Brady.
Yeah, RKP picked it up.
It was wonderful.
Isn't that cool? I
kind of felt like I was hanging out a little bit too long. I mean, if I, I left Velo News and that's it. But I was still kind of hanging around writing this column. And Patrick Brady said, I'll give you the same frequency at the same rate, which is still just twice a month. And he pays me what I was getting paid there for that. And,
that's
you know,
awesome.
Frankly, it helps with my insurance right now.
Sure.
So,
well,
so
in Red
I moved
Kite.
To Red Kite Prairie, and that was really nice. It's a nice move, and, you know, and it sort of finalizes the split, I guess. You know, I guess I'm just going to put those 17 years behind me and chalk them up to a very interesting and positive experience.
Well, that's good. Well, and RKP just was named one of the top 10 blogs in Outside Magazine.
Number one, not just one of the top 10.
Right, it was. It
went
10 to
1.
And Patrick, you know, Patrick and I were trying to get him on the show, and he's like, our hits have gone through the roof. I can't even keep up. So, yeah, I'm really, really glad you're writing for them. That's cool.
Well, I like Patrick. You know, I got my first paycheck from him the other day, and it was, you know, it's a handwritten check in a in a greeting card, and said, you know, this is the first of what I hope is many, many, many more, you know, and it was handwritten, and, you know, I mean, frankly, Velo News was great, and I had a really good experience, but, you know, you get your check automatically deposited, and
right.
There's nothing, you know, this is like it was when I started working for Velo News, you know, when Felix and John and David owned the company, and it was, you know, a small family, and I sort of get that vibe here.
Well, Patrick is a real down to earth guy.
Yeah,
you know, he's
a really
just a really cool guy, and he, I mean, I know a lot about the blog just because somebody else who works on the blog is somebody where our shop is involved with. So,
oh, good.
Yeah, it's just a very, very cool blog, and I'm excited that that you're with it.
I was really pleased, you know, and I I've known Patrick for a long time, and he seemed really eager. Like I said, it was funny because I was just about to email him. You know, when I learned Steve was leaving Velo News, I thought about Patrick's offer, and I thought, you know, this might be the time to do it. And I was crafting an email when my phone rang, and it was Patrick.
Of course.
And I said, hey, man, remember that offer you made? I think I'll do it. And he was just like, wow.
I didn't even have to ask.
Yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah. So I have a question about advocacy, because you are in a really good spot right now, both professionally and given sort of the time you have, although I don't know how busy you are in your practice.
I'm pretty busy.
Cool.
You know, I mean, chemo knocks me out for 2 days a week,
sure.
So I get 3 days a week, and I have to try and punch as much in there as I can. Oh. I've just found out today that I worked on a case for 9 months, and I got all the charges dismissed, so I'm really happy about that.
So,
and the guy who's, you know, charges I got dismissed today is you know, is also a friend. I you know, it's probably not a good idea for a lawyer to do that, but, you know, I actually kind of like my clients. So,
you know what? I don't think it's a bad idea. The law gets a bad rap a lot of the time. Lawyers do. And some of our best customers are attorneys, and we like them for who they are.
I've learned a lot. I mean, some of the biggest assholes I've ever met in my life are lawyers and doctors and such, but some of the most wonderful and kind people I've ever met in my life are, you know, in the same category.
I just don't think that your profession necessarily makes you 100% who you are.
No, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I always used to joke, you know, I've always picked popular professions. I mean, journalists get guided quite a bit, too.
You get knocked around.
And, and then I move on to being a lawyer. I figure that by the time I retire, I'll open a used car lot and I'll get the trifecta, you know.
That's very funny. That's good. So are you going to do any advocacy? Do you see any future in that?
You know, I used to be a member of the board of Bicycle Colorado. And, you know, I mean, obviously at this point in my life right now, I don't think I have the time or the energy to do a lot of advocacy. You know, once chemo is over and I start recovering from all this stuff, I may reconsider. Wyoming doesn't have a big advocacy community. I mean, there are some people that are involved in the issue nationally that actually live here in Wyoming, and it's pure coincidence. My old colleague from Senator Simpson's office, a guy named Mike Tonger, is actually the lobbyist that Bikes Belong has hired. So I know him really well, and so I'm still pretty in touch with that. Particularly, I was thrilled when Tim Blumenthal told me that they were hiring Tonger, because that guy is a scrappy SOB and he works the system really well.
That's awesome. Well, then you kind of are connected, even though you're not doing, you know, a lot of active stuff. You're still connected.
Yeah, and I can write about it, you know. And
true.
Gosh, you know, I mean, when I wrote about that Vail case, I mean, my God, the response to that was just phenomenal, and I had so much fun writing about that. I don't know if you remember, but it was
reported on that quite a bit, actually.
I just loved it doing that story. I mean, it was such a great set of characters, and
so whatever happened to that guy? I know he actually lost his job.
Yeah, he did.
Too bad.
I felt really awful for
that. Maybe we should end on that note.
Well, you know, and the other really cool thing about that is that the district attorney who declined to charge him with a felony because it would have put that guy's job at risk, tried to put an issue on the ballot asking if the district attorney could, if they could up the term limit on the district attorney, and the vote was overwhelming. It was like 67% to no.
Of course.
So, Mark Hurlburt, wherever you are,
I wish you
luck in your new career, but it's not going to be a district attorney.
Exactly.
In
not in Vail.
Yeah.
That is great.
Yeah.
Well, do you have some wonderful plans for the holidays?
I have two really cool kids. My son, as I said, is 17.
Right.
I have an 11-year-old daughter. We're going to try to, spend a lot of time at home. We have a cabin south of town, so we'll probably go to that.
Good.
A little bit, but I can't do a lot of traveling because I've got chemo on Friday the 23rd and Christmas is on Sunday. So,
Well, the Outspoken Cyclist wishes you a ton of luck.
Thanks.
And, a happy, healthy 2012.
I tell you, man, in retrospect, 2012 has got to be better than this year.
been a pretty weird year.
Yeah. Hopefully I'll have better days ahead. So.
And I'm sure you will.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening, Charles. And I'll get back to you and find out how things are going.
Great.
All right. Sounds good. Have a great evening.
You too.
All righty.
Bye-bye.
Charles Pelkey joined us from his law office in Laramie, Wyoming.
Everybody I spoke with this week who learned that Charles was going to be on the show this week just had glowing things to say about him. He is a great guy.
Yeah.
I wish him lots of luck.
Journalist, lawyer.
Bike rider.
Budding cancer survivor.
He the man.
There you go.
He the man. And I'll tell you, Patrick O'Grady and he were hilarious on Facebook this week. I don't even want to go into what they were talking about, but it was funny stuff.
Cool.
Yeah. And he's with Red Kite Prayer, which is really cool. Patrick's going to be on pretty soon. Patrick Brady.
I will have to check that out, because...
the number one blog.
Yeah. I haven't read that, so I've got to go off and get schooled on what's going on over there because that sounds like fun.
All right.
Sounds like it would be fun to take a short break.
It's time, I guess.
And we'll come back and do some news.
Okay.
And then we'll welcome a photographer and a writer who produced a book about cycling in Tucson. And that sounds like it'll be an interesting conversation as well. So
we'll see.
Stay tuned for all that right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
The weather may be getting colder, but it's still just as easy as ever to explore Cleveland Metro Parks with the Hear Here audio tour, running through December 31st in South Chagrin Reservation. At each stop on the tour, visitors can pull their cars into a parking space and tune to 1620 AM to listen for fun facts and interesting stories about the five different sites on the tour. Maps and directions for the Hear Here tour sites are available at clevelandmetroparks.com.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
Yes, we are.
What's new in the cycling world, Diane?
Actually, lots.
Okay.
Okay. So our news this week begins with a popular company, one that Hubbub uses, and you do too.
Who's that?
That would be Velocity.
Yes.
The rim manufacturer.
Yes,
it's a feel-good story.
Okay.
Velocity rims are to be made in the USA.
Really?
This is out of Grand Rapids, Michigan, and that's where your rim came from on your latest encounter with a new rim.
Yeah.
Brothers and partners Tom and John Black will begin manufacturing Velocity rims in Jacksonville, Florida in February 2012. Currently, all Velocity rims are made in Australia, which I knew, and production will cease in Brisbane by the end of November.
Hmm.
Well, we've always been waiting for rims.
Sure.
Oh, yes, that's when, that one's in the next shipment.
Yeah.
No, you have to wait. So, Tom Black, the founder of Velocity, will also be relocating from Australia to Florida, where he will continue to oversee rim production at Velocity's new manufacturing facility. Velocity's distribution center will continue to operate out of Grand Rapids.
Why are they moving from Australia to the United States? It's just more of their market is here, so it makes sense to have them produced
here?
That's
what it seems.
Nice.
That's what it seems. They've been in Michigan since 1992, and it will be their worldwide headquarters. The Australian facility will remain only as a distribution center for the Asian and Australian markets.
Well, I got nothing against Australians, but I guess they'll have to wait for their rims now.
Instead of us waiting for them.
Yeah.
Velocity will be the only U.S.-produced aluminum rim in the cycling industry.
Nice.
Isn't that cool?
Nice.
They make polka dot rims. Did you know that?
Oh, they make all kinds of different colored
rims.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I called to check in this week. I wanted to know about creating jobs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that obviously they're opening the factory. I was told that the number might be difficult to pin down, but they expect to start with between 7 and 15 new jobs that would be created immediately, and that they had some potential for growth in the not-too-distant future.
All right.
Isn't that cool?
Yes.
Okay. So this is out into the future, 2013.
Okay.
2013 is the 100th anniversary of the Tour de France.
Oh, no kidding.
Oh, no kidding. And they are going to do something way different from what they've ever done. The 100-year-old in 2013 will be departing from Corsica.
Oh.
For the first time ever, they've announced the first three stages of the 100th edition tour will start on the Mediterranean island of Corsica. The 2013 Tour de France kicks off on Saturday, the 29th of June. We'll finish on the 21st of July in 2013. Christian Prudhomme, director of the Tour de France, unveiled the program for the 2013 Grand Départ on the island of Corsica.
Hmm.
So the peloton will start in Porto Vecchio in the south of the island for what should be a bunch sprint finish further north in Bastia. From Porto Vecchio, the race will travel south to the cliffs of Bonifacio before moving up north again on one of the rare flat roads on the island to the stage finish in Bastia. And then stage two will give the climbers the first opportunity to express themselves. So they have three mass starts. And there will be the first time trial.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't going to be till after, though. So I thought that was interesting.
And there'll be some hilly stages, mountainous stages right off the bat rather than all sprints and flats in the first week.
That's right.
Hmm.
For the first three stages on Corsica, the 2013 tour could see the yellow jersey change shoulders every day before the race arrives on mainland France.
Hmm. Wake me in a year and a half.
I will do that.
I might watch.
Well, hey, maybe we should just go. I would love to go to Corsica.
There you go.
Yeah. This is by Angie Schmidt from the DC Streets blog.
Oh, yes. You mentioned this.
Only it's about Ohio.
Okay.
It's ugly news.
Really?
Yeah. Here's the subhead. A State Department of Transportation that doesn't try to hide its total disregard for bike ped.
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm. Just how highway-focused is the Ohio Department of Transportation under John Kasich? Well, it's not good. In fact, it's sort of laughably, hilariously terrible, if you don't live here, that is. Yes, ODOT is showing its true colors in its dismissive attitude with the West Shoreway Highway to Boulevard project that Cleveland has been planning for decades. It's clear from this case that ODOT thinks livability projects like Highway to Boulevard conversions are pretty silly, and it goes on and on. And it explains exactly what Kasich is doing. The project has been advanced by three governors of varying political stripes, but already $400 million in desperately needed investment is underway along the corridor. That money is what we in Ohio call economic development, the sort of thing John Kasich has built his whole governorship around attracting, right? Well, but here's the funny part. ODOT let the project go way, way over budget, and now there's not enough to complete the plan. So the city of Cleveland returned to the state for its second round of funding. But ODOT is making it clear they are not enthusiastic about this kind of thing anymore. And it's just sad. It's sad because this is that corridor along the lakefront that needs to be developed. And yeah. Anyway, so that was Streets Blog. That got all the way to Washington.
It's not done yet.
I know. I know. But it's sad. I want to see more development in Ohio. Have you watched the new show Rock Center with Brian Williams on NBC?
No, I have not.
Okay. Well, I actually saw this segment as it re-aired. It was aired like twice. Harry Smith talked with both Traffic Commissioner Janet Sadiq Khan and Mayor Bloomberg of New York about the bike ped changes in New York City. The mayor wholeheartedly endorsed what the commissioner is doing, and the piece was very balanced. It was a great piece. And if anybody's interested, you can watch the video. It's rockcenter.msnbc.msn.com.
Okay.
And it is Harry Smith with the mayor of New York and with the traffic commissioner, who, of course, gets, you know, boos by a lot of people. But I'll tell you what.
She's controversial.
I like the way the mayor stands behind her, though.
Mm-hmm.
It's really cool. And Harry Smith really asked some cool questions.
Oh,
I thought it was interesting.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. We've reported on this in the past, but I want to mention it again. The draft of the Senate's transportation authorization bill, Senate Bill 1813, is moving ahead for progress in the 21st century, is the subhead of the bill.
Okay.
Includes a mandatory side path law for roads on federal land that would force cyclists off certain roads and onto trails and paths, regardless of the condition or utility of the road or path. Yes. There's a petition available if you're interested on the LAB site. If you'd like to know more about it, it's Senate Bill 1813, Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century. It's just a little blurb that says you will have to go on a side path if the land is owned by the federal government. So a state
What was the name of that bill again?
Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century.
Do we always name our legislative bills in opposite of what they really are doing?
Something like that.
Oh, boy.
Something like that.
Uh-huh. I'm not sure that would – well, I'm not sure that'll ever pass constitutional muster.
No, but it can certainly muck things up for a while.
That's the problem with a lot of these initiatives is that they clearly are unconstitutional or more than likely are.
Right.
But everybody, including us taxpayers, has to kick in money to our friends the attorneys.
To get them, booted out.
Well, yeah, to litigate the thing in the courts, right. and decide whether or not it passes muster or not.
Right.
Okay.
Moving on.
Please.
This is my last one.
Okay.
Ever have a problem with dogs when you ride?
Only occasionally.
Well, I think even once is a lot.
That's right. It only takes one dog to ruin your whole day.
This is a few tips for dealing with pushy pooches when you're out riding.
Okay.
This is from Neil Bezdek from Bicycling.com's blog on December 8th. So New York City has its drivers. I just thought his intro was cool. Colorado suffers from an oxygen shortage. Portland is in monsoon. California can't afford to fix its potholes. New England won't thaw until May. The Midwest is a wind tunnel. And the Southeast, my current training ground, has dogs. Every workout is interrupted or enhanced by canines looking for a quick meal. Dogs do pose a real threat to cyclists. Some riders carry pepper spray. Others resort to canine-repelling sirens. But this is where I draw the line. I might shave my legs, roam around in tights, and try to keep my body weight on this side of Feather Light, but I can defend my place in the food chain under my own power. Thank you very much. So next time you're out riding and a hound threatens to make you lunch, keep the following in mind. And here are his tips. And he elaborates on each one, but I'll just give you the headlines. Don't panic. Anticipate what the dog may do. Identify the prey. So in a group ride, for example, dogs almost always go after the lead cyclists on the near side of the road. If that's you, muster your courage. Don't slam on the brakes. If it's not you, distance yourself from the victim and pull out your camera. This guy's funny. Be the aggressor. And I thought this was interesting. Dogs are among the few road hazards that can see you. Use this to your advantage. You can't intimidate a pothole or shout at a patch of gravel, but the best way to fend off hounds is to take their aggression and shove it back at them. Stand up and assume a dominant stance. As the dog nears, make an abrupt swerve toward the dog. Yes, toward the dog, but only enough to send a message not to run over him. Here's my favorite part. Bark as loud and as mean as you can. This works for me every time, and it's kind of fun. Some people squirt dogs in the face with their water bottle, mm-hmm. too. But for every dog it repels, it can also provoke a protective owner.
Hmm.
And lastly, warn drivers. Cyclists already encounter enough roadkill. Let's do our best not to add dogs to their ranks. As motorists approach, I usually make a slowdown sign by holding out and making a patting motion, then point to the dog. So that even though if it's chasing you, the car doesn't run it over.
Is sprint like hell on that list? That's usually my tactic.
Yeah, that's a good tactic if you can outrace them, I guess.
No.
Yeah.
There have been a couple of times I didn't realize I could ride uphill that fast. But if you're being chased by a big enough dog,
yeah.
you can do almost anything
with
on a bike.
With big teeth, too. Yeah, big dog with big teeth.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like and I love dogs.
I like my calves just the way they are.
Yeah,
thanks.
Thank you very much. So that's my news this week.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah.
We are ready to talk to a couple of gentlemen from way out west who
Tucson.
Produced a book about cycling in Tucson.
Yeah, it makes me almost want to move to Tucson.
Well, let's hear about this.
Okay, so let's bring Stefan Walz and Chris Mooney to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening, gentlemen.
What's up, Diane?
Hey.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
I'm good. What's up? What's up is cold and getting ready to snow probably here in Northeast
Ohio. In Ohio, correct?
That is correct. We are in beautiful University Heights, Ohio, which is a suburb of Cleveland.
Well, we had winter on a Tuesday this year.
Greg
all
and I
12
are...
hours of it. Yeah. It was actually cold.
That's funny. We had winter on a Tuesday. Well, we had spring, I think, on a Thursday this year, and that was about it. Other than that, it was raining. So I'd like to start our conversation by saying that your book, Tucson Spokes, a photo collection of the Tucson cycling community,
yes.
is beautiful.
Well, now, thank you.
So what inspired this book?
Yeah, well, this is Stefan.
Okay.
And it came about 2 years ago. Somewhere in the end of 2009, I was finishing up my graphic design degree, and I was going to school at the University of Arizona, and I lived near campus, and I worked on campus, so I was riding my bike everywhere, and of course, I trained to, you know, historically, you know, we don't need to get into that, but I was doing a lot of projects in school that were bike related, and my final project, I wanted to do a type of book. I wasn't sure what kind, and it hit me towards the end of my, you know, tenure as a student that I was seeing all these people on the streets or in certain locations, be them roadies or mountain bikers or commuters. And sometimes they were the same people, and then, you know, being in the community for so long, you hear about these names, and I thought that the photo would be a good medium for that, and then to get their story into the book. And it kind of took off from there, and through 2010, we kind of rested on our laurels, but in 2011, we really made a push and started photographing and getting the people and their stories.
Chris, you're a photographer by profession?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So what's so special about Tucson that it has such an amazing, diverse cycling community? It's huge, it seems.
It is very large. This is Stefan. And I don't know, Chris has been here longer than I have. I got here in 97, and I discovered cycling in the first probably month that I lived here. And when it comes down to it, it really is the weather. You know, we have 300 days of sunshine a year. And as evidence in the book, there's people that commute year-round, there's people that ride year-round, there's people that come here in the winter. You know, we're picking up people now that are coming down here for training, you know, pro and amateur in anything. And it's because they can get out in the middle of the day and they know they're not going to get drenched or have to deal with snow.
Yeah, and that's, you know, this is Chris speaking. I was a good example of this. I was at Halloween. There was some people dressed up in bicycling outfits with from Switzerland. I said, that's a pretty interesting costume. He says, oh, no, we're not on a costume. We're from Switzerland, and we just rode up Mount Lemmon today. Perfect example of the kind of people you meet in Tucson. You know, they're from all around the world. They come here to bicycle in Tucson.
Right, a 90,000-foot peak on Halloween. I mean, that's pretty amazing. You can ride that ride.
So, Chris, you've lived in Tucson most of your life?
Yeah, I was born in Rochester, New York. We moved out here. I had really bad asthma. My parents were told, okay. If you don't move out of this climate, your child will die. So
that's a pretty.
Yeah, it's pretty. So we got here. We got here in 1962.
Okay.
Loaded up the covered wagon and we came out with five kids. I'm a family of five.
Yeah.
And we moved here in 1962, and I grew up here, and of course riding bikes through the Tucson streets, and then the places like Sabino Canyon and Swarnation Monument, just tooling around a little Schwinn Mustang bike. You
know? As any kid, right?
Yeah, as any kid.
Well, Stefan, where are you from?
Well, I hail from a small town called Vancouver, Washington, which is across the river from Portland, Oregon.
Yep.
And we made our way down here in 97, and we've fallen in love with it ever since.
Well, some of the stories that are in the book are really funny stories. There's a story of two guys who hadn't seen each other in a while, and they went to take a mountain bike ride, and one of them fell into one of the cactuses and got cactus needles on his butt, and he ended up taking the other guy's shorts, and the other guy rode home in his underwear. It was hilarious.
Yeah.
It was hilarious. So how did you choose what to include in the book?
We took everything we had, really.
Okay.
I mean, every photo shoot that we went to, we would solicit the cyclists, and we'd say, oh, and by the way, do you know anybody else that should be in the book? And we had we'd go in with 12 names and we'd come out with 24.
Oh, okay.
And we had this running list, and you know, this is a labor of love for us. It's self-published. It's, you know, all the work is done, all the time put in, and all the design and the photography and the touch-up is us. We don't have a sponsorship because that's the way I kind of wanted it. Chris has other opinions on that, but we basically, you know, went as far as we could with it and said, okay, we've got enough material. Let's get it in print and publish it.
Well, have you ever heard of the Kickstarter campaigns?
Uh-uh. What's that?
It's an interesting thing that I've recently come across. So we had a woman on the show named Laura Moulton, and she runs a little organization out of Portland that brings books to homeless people.
Wow.
And she delivers the books on a bicycle. It's
perfect.
Very cool.
Like
it's like a little.
That sounds like somebody should be in a book.
She is somebody who should be in the book. She's pretty amazing.
Yeah, we need to get a picture.
and she's...
We're on a global chase after this. We're going to go world spokes.
Well, I'll tell you what. Laura would be an awesome person in your book. And so there's something on the web called Kickstarter. And it's basically a way to get your project financed by people who are interested. Like next March, which is like a while from now, almost 4 months from now, we're going to have two men from South Africa. And they're working on a series of books called Bicycle Portraits from all over the world. So it's just really cool. And they just have a Kickstarter campaign that is helping to pay for their books. So it's just an idea.
We could have used that about 18 months ago.
So you said you ended up every place you went, you ended up trying to get a couple of names and you ended up with like 20. Are you going to do another edition of the book? Is that something that interests you?
I think Chris can answer that.
Well, yes, I would be interested in doing another book, an expanded edition. That would be the better, you know, because once the book is published, you know, then we have another list. Somebody gave us a list of, 20 names just the other day of people who should have been included in the book. They just weren't available when we did the book.
Aha.
You know, because some people are out of town, they're busy. And, you know, we had a schedule to get this book published. You know, we wanted to get it out before the El Tour de Tucson, which is the biggest bicycling event here in town that tracks 9,000 people. So that was our goal, to get it out before then. But yeah, there's people that we'd like to include in volume two. We have to see what happens, see how this one goes, you know.
Well, Tour de Tucson always produces an amazing poster for their event.
Yes, I used to do the first. I did the first. I started working on the El Tour as one of my first big assignments. I was a volunteer photographer for them for the first 10 years of the event.
Aha.
And I produced all the first 10 posters that they produced.
They were really, really beautiful posters.
Yeah, well, thank you.
Yeah.
It was a combination of the Tucson Mountains poster they did in Cochise County. I probably did about 20 or 30 posters for the Pyrmidine Bicycling Association, which sponsors the event.
Well, Tour de Tucson takes a booth at our trade show every year at Interbike.
Wow,
and
they
give the posters away, and they say, well, how many do you want? And I'm like, well, I can only take one or two, you know. I'm running out of room. But yeah,
they were talking to me. This is Chris again. They were talking to me. They want to do a 30-year – the El Tour's now been for 30 years.
Wow.
and they want to do a commemorative poster of 30 years. And Richard, you know Richard DiBonardis, he's the
yes.
the grand man of that
PBA.
He wouldn't be in my book, by the way. He refused to be in the book.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, Richard did not want to be in the book.
He politely declined.
Politely declined.
Several times.
But I think once it's published, he sees what he'll realize that he has to be in the next one.
Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're talking to Chris Mooney and Stephen Waltz, and they just published a book called Tucson Spokes, a photographic collection of the Tucson cycling community. So what is so special about Tucson besides the fact that you've got 360 days of sunlight, for which we are very jealous here?
Right. Yeah, this is Steph. And, you know, the other thing is there's a lot of, as evidence in the book, there's a lot of advocacy, not only on a grassroots level, but there's people in the county, in the city, who are really behind streets that are safer for not only bikes but pedestrians and children. So there's a lot of political and government workers that are out there ensuring that bike lanes are getting installed with new roads, that are doing infill projects. Like they just finished a loop that connects what we call washes out here. Some people call them rivers, but there's no water in them. And, you know, there's no cars. They go along basically a wash, and they're open for bikes and people. And, you know, they pave them and make, you know, things that go over.
Well, bridges.
Bridges.
This is Chris. Tucson's also trying to push to become a platinum city.
Okay.
Yeah, they were named one of the best I think Outdoor Magazine just pronounced them as one of the best cycling cities in the United States. It's also number two in the world for triathlon training.
And I was going to get to that because the person who did your foreword is a world-class triathlete.
Jimmy Riccitelli, yes.
Yeah. So where do you swim there?
They do have pools here.
Oh, okay, but not open
lots of pools.
See, we
lots
have open pools. Water. We have a big, angry lake.
right now it's pretty angry. Yeah.
Yeah, Lake Erie, it's pretty big.
Yeah.
But what about running and altitude? Do you guys have altitude there? You do a lot of climbing?
Well, yeah, we're at 2,500 feet, and then we're surrounded by mountain ranges that go up to, you know, in an hour you could be at a 9,000-foot peak, you know, with pine trees and...
Well, that's one reason why Tucson is such a unique area for bicycling because, you know, people think that you want to bike on a nice level plane. No, if you're a serious bicyclist, you're looking for mountains all the time.
Sure.
That's what makes life interesting as a bicyclist. It makes you a better bicyclist. Is the more mountains you climb, the better bicyclist you're going to be.
I would agree.
Tucson's very uniquely positioned with climate and geography to attract this type of community.
How big is Arizona?
It's pretty big.
Well, because
it goes all the way up to Nevada and down to Mexico and all across to California, and then you go all the way to New Mexico and you're right there.
Yeah.
You know, the thing about Arizona is we've got Phoenix plopped in the middle with a whole bunch of people in it.
Okay.
And then we've got the Grand Canyon, one of the greatest, most scenic holes up above that.
Right.
But in between, you have... You know, these little jewels, you know, where there are perennial springs like in Aravaipa Canyon, or you can go closer to New Mexico or the White Mountains, you know, and there's lots of open land. And that's one of the nice things is you've got a lot of outdoor recreation in Arizona.
Yeah, there's a lot of hills and stuff around Tucson. But in the city of Tucson itself, it's very level for the commuters.
Uh-huh.
If you're commuting to work, you're not going to be climbing hills. It's not like San Francisco, so I don't want to get that impression. You know, it's the surrounding area that has the hills that you train in. But as a commuter, if you don't have a car and you have to commute every day, you're not going to be battling hills. It's pretty level in the city all around. It's in a valley that is very level.
What would you say the percentage of commuters are? I mean, what kind of population do you have who actually commute to work?
Oh, not enough. You know, we can always use more. That's part of why we haven't got platinum status yet. I don't know. You know, they're doing a study right now with the University of Arizona on the economic impact of cycling in Tucson. And I think that's what they're going to look at. And the county's got, like, I commute my bike to work, and the county's recently published through the Department of Transportation, they've got, like, this
this part of their website where you can go in and you can track your miles, whether you like carpooled or you walked or took the bus or rode your bike, and then they do this equation that tells you how much like money you saved and how much pollution you didn't create. So there's tools like that for people out there that I think just need to get educated to see, you know, to maybe push them to think about commuting on their bike.
Well, it sounds like Tucson is bike friendly on all kinds of levels, that you don't have to beat the government up too much to get facilities for cycling, or is that not true?
Well, you know, we don't live in a perfect world. There's some angry motorists out there.
This is Chris speaking.
We did a show last week, a local radio show, talking about the book, and I think the only two calls that people called in was like, why do you guys ride in big groups and block the traffic? And the other one was, why are they making all these bike lanes? It's hard to drive my car through the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Those are the only two calls we got.
Yeah.
Nice. That's because all the cyclists were out riding their
bikes.
That's right.
They don't have their FM to AM Cirrus radio tuned into. They're on their bicycle.
Exactly. Well, why don't you tell us where this is available so that people can order it. Will it be available in time for the holidays if somebody wants to get it?
Oh, it's available right now.
It is.
You can get
okay.
it online at TucsonSpokes.com.
Okay. TucsonSpokes.com. And it's available now, and it's an 84-page fun book about Tucson and just interesting vignettes of people in the Tucson area. Okay, you guys, it's probably still nice and light and sunny out there, so I'm going to let you guys go for the evening, and thank you for joining me on the show.
Well, thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
All right, have a great holiday.
Okay.
Sell books.
Yeah, we will.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Stephen Walls and Chris Mooney joined us from Tucson, Arizona, where apparently, just like Philadelphia, it's almost always sunny.
Oh, yeah. Almost always sunny. 300 days a year of sun? I was going to say to them, hey, you know what? Well, we have the other 65.
Just about, yeah. Now, that's where Josh Lipton and Bike Shop Hub are
yes.
based, right? I saw the pictures of winter when they said they had winter on a Tuesday.
Yeah.
There was real snow
for
on the ground. Yeah, and there were people riding through it, commuting in the snow and everything. But
yeah. Tell them to come to Cleveland. They want to see some real snow.
I want to take a look at that book when it
when
arrives.
When it finally arrives. I'm telling you, I've been waiting for it for 3 weeks.
We can be patient.
I have no choice.
Sounds interesting.
What I saw was beautiful and really interesting people.
Cool.
Just such cool people.
All right. Well, December rolls on here. It's finally getting seasonably cool in Northeast Ohio.
You mean it's cold. Just call it what it is.
I'm trying to be an optimist.
Uh-huh.
A little euphemistic there.
Yeah, I guess.
We will be back in a week with another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. And I hope your holiday plans are rolling along.
On two wheels.
That's right.
All right.
All right. We'll see you then.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.